Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where news meets insight and analysis and cuts through the noise. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us a bit later, we bring you sharp conversations with the leaders, experts and decision makers who are shaping the world around us. Coming up on the program, Donald Trump's South African land expropriation threat. We'll ask what happens if the pilot can't fly an aeroplane. Predictions on what to expect from tax policies in 2025 and how South Africa's Labour Law and Climate Act can help drive the just transition process. It's Monday, the 3rd of February. Now, land expropriation without compensation remains one of the most contentious debates in our country, and it has sparked international concern now, including overnight from US President Donald Trump, who said it is a powerful human rights violation, his words, and going on to say that South Africa will be punished. Is this alarm justified? Is land reform a necessary correction to historical injustices? Or, as the American government is now threatening or suggesting, a threat to economic stability? I'm joined now by T.K. Puer, who's a public policy specialist at the Wits School of Governance. T.K., a very warm welcome to you. This broadside overnight, has it taken us by surprise?
Afternoon. Yes, it has, but I think it should not have taken us by surprise if you look at what happened in 2018. And here I'm referring to organizations such as AfriForum going to the U.S., I think under Trump's presidency, and sort of putting this issue on the table. And also some of the murmurs you hear from Senate by some Republicans. So I think the manner, obviously, in which Trump has done it was always a bit of a shock, as you can read by how the RAND reacted. But I don't think we should be surprised that he did throw this broadside at the South African government and state.
So where does this leave the South African government now and the kind of response that we are likely to see from Pretoria?
Well, hopefully it'll be a calm response, because what we also have to remember, now I always try and make the point of when you try to read President Trump, is you can't fight the way he does, or else you literally, let's not forget, America is still the largest economy in the world. So what you'd hope from Pretoria would for them to sound out to the president, say, where exactly are you picking this up from and what do you mean by it? Because one of the key tenets of America First would be that you don't actually interfere in the sovereignty of other countries. So I think Pretoria should not really make this a large issue, because that's what he tends to do. And then I think it really doesn't really help our economy much. The key issue should be sound out through diplomatic means. Where did he pick this stuff from? And what book is he reading from? And if there is a point of you can correct him in private, do so. But to make it bigger than to make it a news issue really is not going to help, because you have to remember there is Canada, there's Mexico, there's the European Union. So South Africa's response really might even get lost in the deluge of many states that have got problems with President Donald Trump's first 100 days in office.
TK, this is what the South African government is saying so far, and I quote in part, South Africa is a constitutional democracy that's deeply rooted in the rule of justice, law and equality. The South African government, the statement goes on to say, has not confiscated any land. The president saying that U.S. funding to South Africa is limited to the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, we know it better as PEPFAR, which accounts, he says, for 17% of the country's HIV/AIDS program. So certainly at this point, attempts to downplay the issue.
I probably would have tweaked that, because I think that reads more for us as citizens to say, listen, our sovereignty is not, we're not going to take our sovereignty for granted. I think a better response would have been, you note what he's saying and that you keep it short and sweet. You will make means to find out what he's trying to do, understanding that South Africa is a sovereign state. Because I think the reaction kind of reads as you justifying it to your population, where in truth you should be finding out who is actually in the ear of Donald Trump as it regards to how he views South Africa. I think, for one, I think organizations such as AfriForum have sort of put us in this issue. So I think a better way would have been a shorter statement to say, listen, we're going to sound you out diplomatically to find out how this happens. But it is to be expected. Sometimes I think Pretoria does answer in this manner, but I think it could have been a bit more tactful.
We know the Land Expropriation Bill was signed into law in January, and critics are arguing that tampering with property rights in any way could spook investors and damage economic confidence. So I guess the question is, can we really say that South Africa's economy right now is thriving under the current system, or could some type of reform actually unlock new economic opportunity?
Well, I think on the issue of land, look, I think it's been a long-standing issue which we have needed to sort out. I think, if anything, what this Trump situation does kind of show us is that we should have dealt with this issue a long time ago. Now, how you go about doing it, obviously, some might say it's an ideological issue, but I think there's different ways in which you could have done it. Some certain people argue that, listen, the issue of expropriation was always in the Constitution. You didn't really need to have an act such as this. So I, for one, would probably say, listen, it's if the positive that can come out from this is to actually say, listen, what do we actually mean by land expropriation? How do we really get it to the fore? And understanding the overarching issue of South Africa's historical issue with land, how do we put that first and foremost and ensure that it does? Look, in parts, if you don't explain this carefully, it is going to sound as though South Africa is doing a Zimbabwe 2.0, which is not the case. But I do think it's an issue of saying communicate this better. And also, let's actually have an honest conversation about land in South Africa such that we can, I don't think we can ever fully move on from it, but such that we can actually say, listen, all economic development and tenants does rest on land. How do we do it in such a way that, one, we don't spook off investors, and two, we do address these historical imbalances which have been there? And I think this is where the government of the African National Congress over the three decades has failed at that.
Donald Trump is framing this as a potential human rights violation, but I'm wondering if this is a sincere concern or more about protecting American and Western business interests, given that South Africa is a member of BRICS and there's been a lot of talk, for instance, of a rival or a common currency.
I like the framing of the question, Jim. I think it's what we should look at it as a preemptive strike. He's already stated that he does, I think he finds BRICS to be quite the nuisance. So for me, I also just view it as a point of a preemptive strike to almost remind South Africa that, listen, out of those BRIC countries, you're probably the smallest in this, and this is how I'm going to probably start taking BRICS apart. That's why I said the response needed to be measured and also understand it in the broader context. And most importantly, this is where I think South Africa over the last three decades has failed. What is our grand strategy's response to this? As I said, you should not be shocked. This was always going to happen under President Trump. The key issue we should be asking is, say, what is the South Africa's response to Donald Trump? I would have thought, and I've always made the argument, whether it's PEPFAR or whether it's even a AGOA, South Africa should have been saying, listen, how do we get out of these things as quick as possible? And by getting out means you find replacements elsewhere in the world, and you actually grow your economy to the point where when a state like America does make these threats, and remember, we're not alone in this issue, we can simply, you know, with confidence, because we run our government well, say, listen, we hear you, but if you want to have a conversation with us in a normal way, but you don't just do this off the media. Unfortunately, because of the state of our economy, because of how America is at the moment, we are forced to have to almost have this conversation at the back foot, but also understanding the broader context that he's not happy with BRICS. And what we need is a proper, I'd say, grand strategy response to this, not simply to view this as an isolated incident. Many more things are going to come.
The Rand today trading in a range 1884 to 1904, so down by over 1.3%. TK Poor, thank you very much indeed. Public policy specialist at the Wits School of Governance here in Johannesburg.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, with the 2025 tax year in full swing, many South Africans, both individuals and business, are looking for clarity on key tax changes, compliance risks, and SARS enforcement. So let's discuss all of that with Keith Engel, Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute of Taxation. Keith, a very warm welcome, and I want to start with a story that MoneyWeb is giving some prominence. It says the South African government expects to collect 8 billion rand from the global minimum tax in the 25-26 tax year. The necessary legislation to collect this tax was promulgated at the end of December and the start of this year. What is this and how important is it?
Well, the global minimum tax is something being pushed by the OECD, and this has been in the works for quite some time. So the concept is if a South African company invests in a tax haven and they're not subject to tax, that they'll pick up that the South African Revenue Service can pick up a 15% differential. So this is the same thing that the Europeans are doing, and the British and everybody else has agreed that if you put your money in a tax haven that and you face a zero rate or a low rate, that we can pick up the difference up to 15%. So the money that they're talking about is South African companies investing in some low tax jurisdictions such as Dubai. And then if you manage to get a zero rate there, the South Africa can pick up the difference. Now, the issue is whether the 8 billion. There's only about 17 companies that may have to worry about this, of which 9 have some real money at stake. So I think a lot of people have questioned that number seems a bit high from this minimum tax.
Let's move on to another issue. We're approaching budget 2025. Are there key personal tax changes that are in the offing that we should be looking out for?
Well, there's a lot of noise in the media, and I think we're speculating because they fell short of their revenue. And, you know, well, Kieswetter can only do so much. And so once again, there are a bunch of things on the table of, well, do we need to get more money by changing the legislation? I think the biggest one that people are worried about is the NHI, which would then say goodbye to the medical credits. It's only a matter of time before medical credits go. So I think that's the most at risk. Will they raise personal income tax rates? There's always this threat every year. I think that's – I'm very, very doubtful. The one that people are talking about a little bit more worrisome is a wealth tax, but that's generally in the offing. But they've been pretty smart that I think when it comes to income taxes, they've reached their limit.
And corporate tax rate, any change expected on that front? And if so, what likely impact on business?
Well, there's some discussion to push the corporate rate back from 27 to 28. I think that was a discussion expecting that Trump was going to lose the election. But now that Trump has won and he's saying that he wants to take the 21% rate in the United States and keep it low and drive it lower, there's now beginning to be a counter global push to say raising corporate rates back up is not sustainable. So I'm very doubtful they're going to throw the rates back from 27 to 28, especially when they dropped them from 28 to 27 a few years ago, and then everybody had their losses limited. So I think that would be an act of bad faith. So I think the corporate rates can remain the same.
And Keith, every year there is discussion about the rate of value added tax, but as we well know, this is a political hot potato.
That's right. So you don't see that change, but what you're really seeing is that there are people talking about zero rating items. Now, the Treasury does not want to zero rate items, but the presidency does. So you might see a few zero rating items there. And then the issue for the Treasury is, well, if I'm going to lose some zero rating on the VAT, I need to make it up somewhere else. Do I go after the sugar tax or do I do some things to compensate me for my loss there? But I don't see them raising the VAT. It just doesn't make any sense. It's going to really hurt low income people. It's going to hurt their political base. You know, these people are dreaming on that. One, I think.
As far as the South African Revenue Service is concerned, is there any new thinking in terms of tax auditing?
Well, they're always trying to go there, and I think they're pushing hard. I think the biggest issue that's been pushed for a while is they're trying to push the IT factor more, the data factor more. And the question is Treasury giving them enough funding to do that? Because the real issue and danger for the Revenue Service is not just raising rates on the compliant, but it's the people who underdeclare their income. And it's getting more people who are simply not paying taxes at all, or they're lying about the amount of income they're declaring. And in order to do that, you've got to get third-party data. And unfortunately, we pushed all of this onto the banks. The real problem is we need the rest of government to come along. And so there's sort of discussions back and forth, but you don't see government moving fast enough on this one. And I'm really not sure why the Treasury has been slow, but really it's important for all the departments, all of the agencies to have better tracking information on a variety of things, including the tenderpreneurs. They can pick up a lot of money, but there you see them dragging. So they've been talking about a single taxpayer ID. This is something the commissioner wants, and I fully agree with him on. So you see pushes there, but you don't see any real reaction in government, which I think it's very unfortunate because I think it's a better way of getting money than just raising rates on the compliant.
Keith, as you rightly say, data is the key to all of this and the right data. And SARS, in that respect, is pushing its adaptation or adoption, should I say, of digital tools for tax compliance a lot more aggressively.
Yes, they have to. And I think everybody's trying to go for that because, again, it's sort of AI and whatever. But one of the things that's been pushed is, in the old days, you filed your small business, you file your tax returns, you declare you made $2 million, but you really made about $5 million. And you then the revenue service would have to go back and check. So what they're trying to do is get that ratification. So now what you're seeing, and again, you see this in newspapers, can they say, look, you say that you only had 2 million, but let's look at your bank account. Now, somehow you've gotten 6 or 7 million in there. Now, how are you telling me that you've only made two when you've gotten 6 or 7? So I think there's more pressure to look at your cash flows in your bank account in order to substantiate what you're doing. And that seems to be the space that they're beginning to move to.
And just a final one, businesses and individuals in this tax year, is there anything that they should be thinking of differently to avoid common tax penalties?
Okay, well, I guess the key is you don't want to have a problem with the revenue service. So you really got to keep track on your dates and everything. And this is a problem that's long-standing. There's a lot of tax documents, unfortunately, and you need to be timely. You don't want to have interest charges and other things. So the key is to being on top of your paperwork, and that's always a burden. It's easier said than done. Somebody makes a mistake and whatever, but you don't want to be running into penalties because you're a little bit late or you're finding yourself a little bit short. And that becomes a problem. And sometimes people have cash flow problems where they don't have the money to pay the tax. So the key is to be on top of your tax affairs, pronto and not delay. And that becomes very costly for people. Once they start running into trouble, they get scared and then they hide. And that's the worst thing they can do. So they need to be proactive, is the short answer, as always.
Keith Engel, Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute of Taxation. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa is at a critical juncture in its energy transition. With the newly enacted Climate Change Act of 2024, the country is aiming to balance its ambitious net zero commitments with the protection of workers and industries. But what does this actually mean in practice? And my question is, how can labor law and workplace regulations ensure that the important shift to a greener economy doesn't come at the expense of many who are already vulnerable? Joining me now is Professor Debbie Collier, Director of the Center for Transformative Regulation of Work at the University of the Western Cape. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. So maybe let's start with some of the direct workplace impacts of rising temperatures. How are they affecting workers in different industries?
So the direct effects, of course, are the implications for workers. And we saw this just 2 years ago in January. We saw the death of seven farm workers from heat stroke in the Northern Cape. And there's simple risk management measures that can be taken to prevent that. But more importantly, or rather perhaps more concerning, are the indirect implications that we have to deal with. So working in increased heat leads to a loss of productivity. And studies have shown that heat stress wiped out the equivalent of 4% of Africa's GDP in 2022. Globally, it's around 2%. Places a strain on our public services, demands on the public health system, including responding to extreme weather events, which we've seen increasingly, for example, the KZN and Eastern Cape floods. So it creates pressures on public health and our public services. So all round, it's something we really have to approach differently, and our Climate Change Act gives us the opportunity to do that.
So in terms of that different approach then, are there specific all-purpose protections that now need to be in place for people during this transition?
So I think we do need to see a much greater level of coordination, and the Climate Change Act gives us the opportunity for this coordination. So it's bringing disaster management mechanisms into that labor law and world of workspace. It's updating our occupational health and safety considerations. We really need to bed down our social protection for workers. One of the problems with our labor law actually is it's got a rather narrow scope of application. So, and we all know our high levels of unemployment and inequality. So some of the sort of longer term mechanisms that we need really need to coordinate labor law with other forms of interventions. Skills development will become critical, of course, as we transition to a decarbonized economy.
Aside from the skills development, what other obstacles do you see then to that coordination or collaboration that you refer to?
We'll talk about funding as an obstacle, often as a country, but I think the obstacles are quite often human, and human behavior, and the human ability to adapt and change. Our laws we can change quite easily, but we really need to change how we have the conversation around a transition. So economies that have been and countries that have achieved better outcomes, both in terms of equality, achieving greater levels of equality, greater levels of employment, sustainability, there's always a much greater consensus on the goals. And there's a commitment to achieving those goals. So there's much higher levels of trust and transparency and engagements. And that makes it easier to plan and coordinate for the just transition. So the barrier is often a human one. We really do need to have that dialogue and consultation at all levels. And, traditionally, our labor law, our world of workspace has been an adversarial forms of collective bargaining between industry and organized workers, with government playing a key role there, but government's role become increasingly important. But also we need to expand the scope of what we're focusing on. Labor law and industrialization has not been concerned with the environment at all. It's been concerned, with how do we distribute the economic gains of industrialization. And I think we need to realize industrialization got us to this problem. So we can't use the same tools. We need new tools. But we have a good framework for that.
And Professor, given the competing social and economic priorities in this country, you talk about the importance of the conversation to start happening. Are you confident that there is the appetite, the wherewithal to have that dialogue?
I've engaged within the NEDLAC space and the PCC Presidential Climate Commission, and there's certainly an appetite to have the dialogue, and the right conversations are taking place there. But we need to see that translating to conversations on the ground, and we need, much greater sectoral conversations taking place at sector and industry level. We have these industry master plans. What are they doing, and how are they coordinating this? And then down to workplace level, local governments are going to become more important, because if we, by transitioning to green energy, we are going to fragment the energy and just redistribute energy. It's currently really centralized. That will be distributed down to local level. So we really need to have everyone in on the conversation. And there are pockets of where this is happening. And sometimes it's a stuckness about not realizing where the places are to speak, and to have the conversation.
The Act also includes a goal of something called decent work. What is that?
So decent work is, this is for labor lawyers, is quite an eye-opener, because we have the term embedded in decent work embedded in the way we think and talk about labor law, but we've never actually included it in legislation. And it's an ILO, International Labor Organization, concept around decent work, which has, four pillars to it. I don't think we have enough time to go into it, but it is about social dialogue, about rights at work, and having access to, acceptable forms of work. And so that for me really sparked the conversation with climate change law. How can we use climate change law actually to achieve the objectives of labor law? Labor law also is, it's constantly under existential crisis, precisely because we have high levels of unemployment. We talk about the informal economy, and if we look on the continent, there's more happening in the informal economy than there is in the formal economy. So labor law really also needs to find its niche in this climate change environment to be useful and to sustain itself. So the decent work in the Climate Change Act, it allows us to tie these two pieces of legislation together. And, as I mentioned, I mean, industrialization and work, labor law itself has been part of the carbonization process, and use of fossil fuels has generated these rules. So we really do need to look at the objectives of labor law as well.
Let me touch on one final issue, if I can. I think this is a commonly held belief now that automation and artificial intelligence is going to lead to job losses as companies start to go green. The challenge, of course, is to balance efficiency with employment, and that's something that organizations are starting to grapple with.
Yeah, it's a big issue. I mean, I think AI and automation, it can create much more efficient systems. We don't need as many low-skilled workers if we move to renewable energy systems. So this does create challenges, and it really, the importance is around planning and not assuming that new jobs will be created, because there is, the prospects are rosy that we can actually create more jobs, but we really need to look at what that means on the ground. I think we really need to have a broader look at our economy and the types of work that we value. Low-skilled workers are using technology and AI. We look at Uber, we look at, you know, the delivery workers, and we actually need to look at ways of protecting workers who are already making use of that because they actually fall outside of the net of labor protection. So it really will take a lot of, if we don't do the skills training, we really are, it's going to be a transition, but not a just transition. And that's a crisis, and that's going to be very disruptive. So it really will take a lot of proactive skills training. We need to value workers in other forms of work. And we're seeing this, you know, happening, care workers, for example. I mean, I've mentioned the Uber workers, waste reclaimers and recycling, you know, our circular economy. Gig workers. I mean, we look at the disaster in the informal and artisanal miners. We should be building up measures of protection there as well, and making sure that we're creating decent work and work that currently, frankly, is not at all decent.
Professor Debbie Collier, thank you very much indeed, Director of the Center for Transformative Regulation of Work at the University of the Western Cape.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, it's not every day that you hear a mid-flight announcement asking if there's a pilot on board. Well, that's exactly what happened on FlySaf Air's flight from George to Johannesburg last week. And it did spark some wild speculation online. Some claimed that a random passenger had to land the plane. But let me tell you, the truth is far less dramatic. The co-pilot handled the situation smoothly. The flight landed safely at OR Tambo. But we thought it does raise an interesting question. What happens if a pilot is incapacitated, is suddenly unable to fly? So we turn our attention to respected aviation commentator, the editor of SA Flyer magazine, Guy Leach. Guy, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the facts. Do you know exactly what happened on that flight?
Yeah, hi, Jeremy. Well, I mean, I've spoken to FlySaf Air and have a pretty good idea from the other broader reports. The fact of the matter is that the captain got incapacitated. Fortunately, he didn't die behind the controls. And they left him in the seat, which is always a big decision. That left just the co-pilot to fly the aircraft. Now, let me just reassure your listeners that co-pilots are absolutely fully qualified to fly the aircraft themselves. In fact, most of the time, the captain and the co-pilot take it in turns to fly the plane. So there was no question about the co-pilot not being able to handle the aircraft and land it. But there is, especially in modern aviation training, there's a thing called CRM, which stands for Crew Resource Management. And what that means is that it means that you don't just ask the captain or the pilot for any answers and expect them to know everything. You ask around. You rope in as many people as you can to solve a problem. Sometimes you'll ask the air traffic controllers, can they help? But if you're down to one pilot and the workload's going to be quite heavy because you're flying into a busy Johannesburg, it's recommended practice that you put out a comment, is there anyone else on the aircraft who can fly, you know, who can help out with the procedures?
And that makes perfect sense, Guy, but I think it's the announcement itself that caused the stir. And I guess people are asking if it was necessary to ask for a pilot on board. I guess, you know, any ordinary passenger sitting there might have jumped to a wild conclusion. I think I would have.
Absolutely. You know, you've really got a feel for FlySaf Air. I mean, yes, they brought down a heap of trouble on themselves with this huge ongoing dispute about the limitations of ownership. But then they've also had endless other problems with, you know, drunk passengers. And they've just been in the news for all the wrong reasons. And, of course, it certainly doesn't help to have an announcement from the cockpit saying, are there any pilots on board? But it helped because they found a pilot, even though he was just a private pilot who actually wasn't qualified on the aircraft, but he was able to be a big assistance in managing to read out the checklists and keep an eye out and so on. And just to add another point to the information that went out there, the co-pilot landed the aircraft perfectly safely, but then he had a big problem because the steering tiller, when you're on the ground taxiing, you steer it with your hand with it on a tiller. Mm. That's on the captain's side. So they couldn't steer the airplane, so they had to just leave it in the middle of the runway while they came and got the captain out and then were able to tow it back. So all in all, a very embarrassing episode for FlySaf Air, the last thing they needed. But no safety threat, and it's the thing that makes what novels and books have been a popular idea for years.
I have read many of them, as I'm sure you have. Let me ask you this. You talk about that checklist that the pilot had to read out on landing at ORT. Are there not safeguards that would have included just landing on automatic pilot?
Yeah, but to land on auto land system, it's an incredibly complex system of checks and balances, and you've got to have three autopilots that all agree with each other. You've got to have two pilots actually monitoring the whole system, because you've got one pilot monitoring and one pilot flying, even though the autopilot's flying. And you've got to have everyone current on the whole system. That means they've got to have practiced it in the last little while. So in theory, while it could have been switched on and engaged and the auto land worked, it wasn't going to be an option at this stage. But it does raise the next interesting point, which is that there's an increasing amount of pressure on airlines to move to single pilot operations. And of course, this is the perfect antidote to that claim. You know, you can't have a single pilot if pilots are going to get sick.
Guy Leach, editor of SA Flyer magazine, always appreciate the input. Thank you very much indeed. And that's also our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.